This podcast includes information provided by the issuer and does not express the views of the interviewer. This podcast may also include forward-looking statements by the issuer that involve certain risks and uncertainties to its business. Because forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties, the issuer's actual results could differ from those indicated in this podcast. Welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you all so much for the support and for tuning in. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Bobby K. Kraft. That's B-O-B-B-Y-K-K-R-A-F-T, and you are listening to episode 33. When you get a chance, if you like what you hear, it would be awesome if you rate and review the podcast on iTunes. This really does help because I would love the feedback. For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I spoke with Bill Hench, portfolio manager at the Royce Funds. For more than 40 years, Royce & Associates, investment advisor to the Royce Funds, has been managing microcap, small cap, and small midcap portfolios. Bill and his partner, Buzz Zaino, run the Microcap Opportunity Fund and the Opportunity Fund. I wanted to speak with Bill to get his perspective on microcap investing. A couple of things stood out in our interview, including Bill and Buzz's four themes on portfolio construction, his definition of cheap stocks, but I thought Bill's point about diversification versus concentration as a microcap investor was also intriguing. He brought this point up multiple times throughout our interview. The goal for this episode is to learn about Bill's approach to portfolio construction, advice for new microcap investors, his stance on diversification versus concentration, and much more. Thank you again for tuning into episode 33 of the Planet Microcap Podcast. Please enjoy my interview with Bill Hench, but first, a word from our sponsor.
Are you a microcap investor? Would you like to meet with management? If you're a loyal listener to the Planet Microcap Podcast, you know the importance of qualitative due diligence. The producers of this podcast invite you to attend the Planet Microcap Showcase, a microcap investor conference on April 26th through April 28th at Planet Hollywood Resort and Casino in Las Vegas. The Planet Microcap Showcase is 2.5 days of company presentations, networking opportunities, and private one-on-one meetings with company management of undiscovered and well-known microcap companies. So join us at the Planet Microcap Showcase, April 26th through April 28th, at the Planet Hollywood Resort and Casino in Las Vegas to network with like-minded microcap investors and find new opportunities. For more information, go to www.planetmicrocapshowcase.com and register now to reserve your spot. Look forward to seeing you all there.
For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I have Bill Hench on the program. He is a portfolio manager at the Royce Funds. Bill, welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast.
Thanks very much.
It's great to have you on my program. Thank you for joining me. So to start off, as we do with every interview, you know, what is your background?
Sure. So I was at one time a CPA, and I was also a controller, and I did worked with some people who ran some currency trading and derivatives trading, but I was given an opportunity to get involved in equity sales, probably over 20 years ago, and was fortunate to get some real good training from people who loved the market and loved stocks and were good investors. And throughout sort of my career, I've been very, very fortunate to have a bunch of people like that who were very gifted investors, but also, you know, just as important and more important for me, willing to sort of share their insights and helpful hints along the way.
So what got you into investing in microcap stocks?
Well, market, right? It's the least covered. It's the part of the market where you get to really dig deep and find great companies and great people, and you get rewarded for it, right? So there's not a lot of coverage. The companies are really, really interesting. You know, many of them are entrepreneurial. Many of them are still run by the man or woman who may have founded it. So there's a great amount of excitement, and just as importantly, a great ability to make a lot of money doing it.
So you manage the Opportunity Fund and the Microcap Opportunity Fund at Roysa. Can you describe each for me?
Sure. So the Opportunity Fund is a fund that I manage with my partner, Buzz Zeno. And it's a process that he started probably about 35 years ago, where it's essentially a small value fund. But what we do is we just find things that are really, really cheap, and then, you know, look for something that's going to be happening to sort of get that stock from being one that's cheap for a reason to one that all of a sudden maybe have attributes of either growing again or turning itself around to be something that, you know, has attractive returns. So that's what we do in that fund. We'll buy things up to about $2.5 billion. Traditionally, half of the fund is in micro names and the other half is in small cap names. And then we have a newer fund, which is much smaller in assets, called the Microcap Opportunity Fund. And that's a little more concentrated. And by concentration in our world, we say 100 names or less. Mm-hmm. With liquidity being difficult all the time, one of the things that we, you know, really, really stress to people is that you have to be diversified. Because no matter how great your think your investment acumen is, and no matter how wonderful a company seems, and no matter how much research you think you've done, you're always subject to, what we call, for lack of a better term, left field events, things that you never really thought of as sort of being a risk. And, you know, in small cap investing, micro cap investing, the things that are an annoyance to big companies, you know, could be terminal to little companies. Mm-hmm. So one of the best ways to sort of address risk is to be diversified.
Mm-hmm. I want to stay on that topic because, you know, there's a difference in philosophy sometimes. You know, there's some investors, and it might be different because, you know, you're running a fund, but, you know, there's some individual investors who are all about concentration. And then there's others who are like, well, you know, it's good to be diversified, but there's two sides to each of it. You know what? Why would you argue for wanting to be on the, I mean, you kind of mentioned why a little bit more, but, you know, why would you be opposed to maybe being more concentrated?
Because there are special risks inherent with tiny companies, right? Mm-hmm. Principally, it's liquidity, right? So if you're running a large amount of money, as we do, we run, you know, about $2.5 billion. Liquidity is an issue. Financing is an issue for these companies, right? They don't have the same access to the capital markets as a lot of the bigger companies do. And lastly, you know, management is a risk. Now, I'll tell you that these management teams are very, very good. They're good at what they do. They're good at in entrepreneurial spirits, and they're good at hiring. They're good at executing. But by their nature, you know, the management teams tend to be a lot thinner. So there's a lot of reliability on a couple of people, right? There's no bench. You know, the big companies can go out and recruit from the schools and put people through their programs, and they get to see all the different parts of the company, and they're well versed as they go up through the ranks, right? Now, with smaller companies, you know, many times you're reliant on, you know, the woman who runs sales or the guy who's in charge of R&D or the CFO, and there's, you know, there's just much more risk there. So in order to mitigate that risk, you know, one of the things that we have found over, you know, a long period of doing this is that diversity really helps. Mm-hmm. I have many, many good friends who run concentrated portfolios, and that's terrific, and it's a strategy that works for them. In the part of the market, especially in the value side or the distressed, some of the distressed stuff that we do, concentration kills, you know, for lack of a better term, because it's just too many things that can happen in the small cap world. Things that you think you don't have to worry about when you're doing big cap investing, you know, truly are a worry. Mm-hmm. Principally, those things I talked about.
So I actually want to hit on one other thing that you answered when I asked about your description for the funds, and I love it when I hear this, and that's the, you know, you want to look for cheap stocks. You know, I love that phrase because it means something different to everybody. You know, so what does a cheap stock mean to you?
So to us, it's very like to buy things that are cheap on a price to book and a price to sales basis, right? Mm-hmm. So you want to buy stuff that's close to book, because guess what? You're not going to be right all the time, right? Mm-hmm. So when you are wrong, you don't want that to kill your portfolio. So it's much easier to recover from things that are bought at book value or 2x book versus things, you know, that are bought at 8x book and they get beat up and you got to cross your fingers and hope, my goodness, I hope it comes back, hope it comes back. So it mitigates your losses. And on the price to sales, it's a good measure of what this, you know, what the entity can do, what kind of earnings can you get if you sort of normalize margins, right? So those are two things that we spend a lot of time looking at as far as calling things cheap, right? We tend not to look at PE because, you know, we buy a lot of turnarounds. We buy a lot of busted IPOs. So most of the types of names that we buy when we buy them are either under-earning or perhaps not making any money at all. So that's why we sort of don't pay much attention to the sort of PE at the time of the purchase. You know, what we really want to do is see, okay, what can this thing earn a year and a half, 2 years out, and what kind of multiple can you get on that?
Mm-hmm. So
that answers the cheap question.
That I think so. I let me ask the audience. Okay, wait. I'll have to wait till next week for that one. Anyways, so going right along, you know, on your website, you mentioned that in the funds, you know, it asset plays, turnarounds, undervalued growth stories, and interrupted earnings are the four themes for portfolio construction. You know, why focus on these themes?
Well, my partner Buzz Zeno, when he was sort of describing the fund and talking to clients and telling people what types of situations he looked for, those were the types of things that showed up when you looked for companies with the attributes that we liked. So if you look over time, the fund has pretty much had the same breakup amount of these names in each of those little buckets, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it's really what the market looks like, right? So if you're looking sort of in that area that has those stats that we like to look for, right, the low price to book, low price to sales, you're going to find those types of names in there. So that's really what populates the market mm-hmm. on the value side.
Mm-hmm. And then and just to kind of follow up on that a little bit more, you know, So in your experience, you thought that, you know, focusing on these four themes, you thought was where you could really find the value, because they, you know, some of them are, fallen stars or, you know, something like that. And this is where, at least in your experience, you thought, okay, let's start here and see what we can find that might be kind of interesting.
I'd like to take the credit for it, but it's really my partner who came up with this. I fully buy into it. Otherwise I wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. You know, what those four themes really are, you know, what you're really looking for are things that are currently trading like their value stocks, but you really want to get multiples that the growth stocks get, right? Mm-hmm. So when these things do work, right, when the turnaround is executed, right, mm-hmm. When the interrupted earnings or the broken IPO regains its growth metrics, you know, you want to get that multiple, and that's what really sort of drives the performance over time, right? You're buying something and people say, oh, look, it's just a, you know, it's a chemical company or it's a, you know, it's an auto parts company and those things don't really grow. But then all of a sudden something happens in the market, right? All of a sudden, you know, there's this tremendous event, right? Where there's bankruptcies and the whole industry goes through a very, very difficult time. And what emerges? Sort of less companies. And now all of a sudden there are less companies, so there's less competition. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, there's a global component to their sales. And all of a sudden these things that used to grow at 3 or 4 or 5% are now growing at 10, 11, 12%. But if you can catch them while everybody still thinks they're only going to grow 3 to 4 to 5, and then sell them when everybody says, holy cow, look at these things. They're double-digit growers, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you could make a good return. So that's what we're trying to do over and over and over again.
Got it. So then does that, the term, the deep value strategy, does that fit into that overall theme, or does that mean something completely different?
It fits into actually all the four themes that we look at, right? Because again, you know, you have what are you calling deep value, right? Mm-hmm. You're calling stuff that really looks distressed, right? And why is it distressed? You know, it could be because, you know, maybe they make telecom equipment. And guess what? There were two big mergers last year. And so their sales stink, right? Well, they don't stink because it's a bad company. They stink because there's a limited amount of customers, right? Mm-hmm. And they stop buying. So even the best management in the world isn't going to be able to execute good numbers, you know, in an environment where your customers aren't buying, right? So these things turn into, you know, quote-unquote deep value situations, right, where they have shown no sales growth or maybe negative sales growth. You know, maybe they've got debt. But, you know, when you look deep into these things, you can usually find something to sort of hang the story on, right? Okay, yeah, right now things look really bad, but guess what? This management may have seen this before, or perhaps, you know, during this really fallow time for earnings, maybe they were investing in other products, or maybe, you know, when the merger activity is over and the customers stop buying, you know, maybe all that old inventory that was written down to the levels is now going to be sold at a premium price. And so, you know, there's the deep value, right? But you know, as we jokingly say, nobody really wants to own a portfolio full of value stocks, right? It's boring. You're not going to make any money, right? You want stuff that's going to be perceived as growing, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it has, you know, something that's going to make it attractive to people that want to be paid for growth.
So also in one of your videos, and you actually mentioned this a little bit earlier, but you also mentioned that a third of the portfolio at any given time includes turnarounds and broken IPOs, quote unquote. You know, so how do you assess companies that you think fit this mold for potential investment?
Sure. So we don't play the new issue market because most of the stuff is just too expensive for what we do, right? Doesn't mean that they're not good companies or they're not good deals. It's just, you know, most companies that come public tend to be doing very well at the time, right? Otherwise, they wouldn't be coming public. So they're, you know, on a growth trajectory, and there are expectations for them to continue that, right? When the buyers come in, you know, they're buying something because it's growing at X, right? So what happens in some instances with these deals is that, you know, a couple of quarters out, sometimes even the first quarter out of the box, something happens where they disappoint, or perhaps a competitor has an issue, and then there's a perception that maybe they'll have an issue, so it's not going to grow as much. And when these things disappoint, they tend to go down a lot, mm-hmm. right? There's no history, right? They're sort of, you know, blank slate, right? So all of a sudden, you know, two quarters out, they're disappointed. Mm-hmm. So everybody runs for the exits because those people have their disciplines too, right? Mm-hmm. And you're left with these things that there's no natural buyer for them, right? Because mm-hmm. they're broken on the growth side, and the value people, you know, not cheap enough, if you will, for the value of people, right? Mm-hmm. So the way we look at it is we say, okay, well, what do you really have here? In a lot of instances, you have a really good company with a great balance sheet, usually, because they just, you know, they just raised money in their deal, and you have a stock available. And so the broken IPOs to us, or the interrupted earnings, are really companies that we think, you know, are temporarily in a funk, but with a little time can maybe go to start growing again 15-20%. Mm-hmm. And, you know, over the history of the fund, those have been, you know, some of the bigger winners. Mm-hmm. And if you look in this last cycle, there's been a whole host of names that have come out, and for whatever reason, everybody runs for the exits. The stock go from, you know, $12 IPO prices that opened up at 15, went to 18, then all of a sudden they're 4. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm not exaggerating. You know, you buy a lot of these things for 2 times the cash on the balance sheet. You have to be patient, though. You know, they're not going to turn around in a quarter. And, you know, in many instances, you know, you're buying this today, and guess what? If they just had a crummy quarter, chances are next quarter is probably going to be pretty crummy too. But if you're patient and if you can average into these things over time, build yourself a nice position, when that turns, it could be pretty dramatic. Mm-hmm.
So another phrase I wanted to get your comment on is this idea of exploiting market inefficiencies. You know, it's a key phrase that many microcap investors and funds find attractive about microcap investing. You know, what does this phrase mean to you?
I don't know. Did I ever say that? But we do. I mean, it's funny because people say to us, okay, you know, what do you do well? What's the special sauce, right? What, you know, why would we want to buy the fund? And you know, honestly, it's the fact that we've been through this before, right? We've been through the cycles. And in microcap, you do get a chance to really exploit what happens, right? So what happens in our world? So in 2002, in 2008, 2011, and on the value side in 2015 and the latter half of 2014, a crummy market for these stocks, right? And when you have a crummy market for stocks that are sort of illiquid and not well followed to begin with, you get very, very exaggerated drops in price, right? And you could probably look at, you know, if you ran some sort of Russell 2000 screen for 2015 and 2002, you'd see some incredibly large amount of stocks, especially those ones considered value, that were down, you know, 30, 40, 50%, right? And then if you look at the stuff that isn't even in the Russell, the really tiny stuff, right, the macros, the micro stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You know, these are $4, $3, $6 stocks, right? You know, take a $5 stock, right? It goes down 50 cents, you know. Oh, my goodness, I've just lost 10% of my money. You know, but it works the other way, too, right? You know, it goes up from there 50 cents. Oh, my goodness, look at these huge percentage gains they make, right? You have this natural bias. People don't want to buy $3 stocks. They don't want to buy $5 stocks. They don't want to buy dollar stocks. Oh, they're no good. They're low quality. Right? You know, there's one phrase that, you know, drives me nuts. It's, well, people say it's a low quality stock. I don't know what that means. You know, to me, a low quality stock is when you don't make money, and then a high quality stock is when you make money. Right? But you get to exploit this stuff because the liquidity stinks, and in the bad market, you know, the stocks, you know, as my partner likes to say, the prices just become numbers. They don't really represent any sort of value, right? It's just a number that the stock will trade at. The good news is that reverses when the microcap market is hot. If you're a portfolio manager and you own all these things, you essentially become a market maker, right? Mm-hmm. Because people try to look for stock, and guess what? Luckily for you, you've accumulated it. You know, you've spent the last 3 months accumulating 1.5 million shares of something that, you know, trades 30,000 shares a day, and, you know, has a much bigger spread than most of the other names. Mm-hmm. So if you can take advantage of the really bad markets, you tend to do really, really well coming out of these things. The only problem with that is that your numbers stink in the bad markets, right? Mm-hmm. Because you can't get defensive. And in point of fact, you've got to get very aggressive. And if you look at what we do in the bad markets, it's, you know, we're really beating our own performance up, right? We're bidding down on things that we already own, mm-hmm. taking advantage of the illiquidity. And in the short term, it looks really, really terrible. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the history of the fund, you'll see that, you know, this is not a place where you're going to, you know, you have to go to get cover in the bad markets. Mm-hmm. You know, it's self-serving to say, but we say, you know, those are really the times where we make a lot of money, right? Because that's when you get the merchandise at the really, really, really low prices. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I could remember in 2002 when tech was blowing up, I can remember, you know, my partner and I were walking over to see a client, and my cell phone rang, and it's, you know, it's one of our traders, and said, you know, that thing we just bought at 80 cents. I said, yeah. He said, well, another 100 show up. You know, at 60 cents. He said, my goodness, you know, they have a dollar in cash in the balance sheet. There's no debt. You know, they're not really burning any. It just doesn't make sense. But it doesn't. And so, you know, if that's what you were talking about, you know, that phrase that I guess I did say at some point, that's probably what I meant.
Well, it makes sense. You know, I mean, it seems that micros are always, and you could probably speak to this in experience, it always seems like those are, you know, for those who aren't specifically microcap investors, like that seems to sometimes be the forgotten part of their portfolios. And when it comes to hard times, like those are usually the first ones to go without any good reason. I mean, am I wrong in saying that?
But it's, you know what, it's your natural inclination to want to do that, to get rid of it, you know, get it. I don't want to look at it anymore. Mm-hmm. Every day I look at it, it's down. I look at my portfolio, it's down. Just get it off the, yeah, get it off the portfolio. I don't want to look at it. Just sell it. But it's down 10. Don't worry. Just sell it. Yeah, and this way it's gone. You don't have to look at it anymore. And you know, and there's a lot of that. And again, you know, there's a stigma about having a very, very low stock price. Mm-hmm. You know, and some people by perspective can't buy things, you know, under $5 or under $3.
Right. Well, for you guys, like what is the criteria for when you do finally liquidate a position?
So there's good liquidations and bad liquidations, right?
Right.
So good liquidation is everybody decided that, hey, this thing is really a growth stock and we're going to give it this big multiple. So we'll sell it. You know, we buy and sell things very deliberately, right? So you don't want to upset the market. You don't want to go in and try to buy 100,000 or sell 100,000 of anything, right? Mm-hmm. You sell 5, 10, 15 a day. And conversely, when you're buying something, you buy 5, 10, 15 a day. So we sell when things reach what we think, you know, are a fair value, right? And with microcaps, it'd be nice to say, you know what, I think this thing is worth $15. And guess what? Oh, look, it's 15. I want to sell my 1.5 million shares at 15. Good luck. You know, unfortunately, there isn't anybody stupid enough to buy, you know, all your stock at the top. And there's nobody stupid enough to sell you all the stock at the bottom. So our sale process is when things start to work out and they get to what we think is fair value, we're going to slowly put that back into the market. The other time we sell is when things get materially worse than we thought, right? Because we're usually buying things, you know, that are pretty, if they're not distressed, they're pretty depressed. So if something happens to make it even worse, or it looks like there's going to be a big impairment on the balance sheet, we'll sell it. You hate the price. But because we're so diversified, not going to ruin you a year. You take what you can get for it and you walk away. Mm-hmm. And then the third time that we sell is if you get some sort of event where all of a sudden everybody has to have it, right? So, you know, something happens, there's an unexpected outcome in an election, and all of a sudden everybody needs to own this stock, right? So we owned a fair amount of infrastructure stocks. That's a nice word to say. Infrastructure, right? So we have all these infrastructure stocks, and the day after the election, I think half of them, you know, the bad ones were up 15%. So that's another way that we'll sell. And then finally, you know, we get a lot of takeovers in microcap land, so we probably had 20 names taken over this year. So we'll usually exit them to the ARBs if the spread's tight enough.
Mm-hmm. And sorry, one thing you said earlier that I loved, and I wanted to repeat it because I wanted to make sure I remembered it myself. I love that phrase, you know, low quality stocks are the ones where you don't make money, and high quality stocks are the ones where you do make money.
That's true, right? I mean, there really is, you know, you don't get any extra credit if you buy something that's quote unquote high quality, right? Yeah. I guess you could tell your friends you own something that's high quality, but yeah, that's exactly right, though, right? Yeah. There's a price for everything. Mm-hmm. And if you could get something at a discount, you know, the money is no less green.
Yep. I like that. There's no extra credit. That's for sure. Another question I had is, you know, do you ever overweigh one sector or another? And conversely, do you avoid any sectors in their entirety, you know, at any given time?
Yeah. So I'll take the second part first. So, okay. We pretty much avoid biotech for two reasons. One, we just don't have the skill set for it. And secondly, most of the microcap biotechs don't have any revenue. And if they do, it's usually milestone payments. So for what we do, remember the two things that we really like are low price to book and low price to sales. So lots of the biotechs do have really good price to book ratios, right? Because they've got all this cash usually and no debt. But the lack of sales makes it tough for this type of exercise that we do. As far as sectors, overweight, underweight, we don't consciously say, gee, I want to own more tech or I want to own more financials, what really happens is you start to look at a name. For instance, after the housing crisis, we started looking at the home builders. And guess what? You look at one, and chances are in a situation like that, there's probably going to be four, five, six, that are similar to it. And all of a sudden, you've got a quote-unquote bet or a sector bet, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not, it didn't start out as let me go buy all the housing stocks. It started out as, look, I'm looking at this name, and it's cheap, and I think this could happen, and this could make it attractive in the future. And then all of a sudden, you buy the suppliers, and then all of a sudden, you buy the mortgage insurers, and you have a big housing bet, right? And you mentioned, we were just talking about the infrastructure. We were buying infrastructure last year because, one of the things we do is we tell people we subscribe to, and more importantly, read a lot of trade journals. And if you read the engineering trades and the other building trades, you'd see that there was a little more activity coming up. And, it's no secret that there needs to be some sort of repair done to the country's infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So you had the right prices as well. And so all of a sudden you had 10, 12, 13, 14% of your portfolio in things that related to infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, we've had a lot in tech, and we've had a lot in industrials. The tech stuff is very appealing to us because there's a lot of names, right? There's a lot of new companies all the time. But those companies also tend to have a healthy, healthy balance sheet. Mm-hmm. They tend to have lots of cash, no debt. And, in the difficult times, right, when you're buying them, you can feel good about the future for them because they usually keep spending on R&D. So when the sun comes out against the tech, they usually have good new products. And good new products usually mean good margins, and good margins usually attract growth investors, and you get good multiples. Mm-hmm. We look at just about anything that we can, save for biotech.
Got it. So this is one of my favorite questions, if not my favorite question. And I'm going to ask it a little differently because it seems that you, when you came into microcap investing, you kind of adopted your partner's way in which, he figured out his themes for portfolio construction. So what I would say is, what was the experience that helped shape you where you were like, aha, like that's, I'm really happy I subscribed to this investing strategy because it worked out, this way. Can you comment on that?
Right. Sure. So I didn't have the sort of background in the thematic approach that he had, but I did prior to joining him, like to buy the cheap, mm-hmm. Value plays, especially in tech, mm-hmm. which not that many people had a lot of interest in. So I had worked with some people. I worked with a wonderful broker up in Boston who had worked at Hamburg and Quist, which was one of the great firms out west, and learned a lot about tech investing and investing in things that, first glance didn't look so attractive. But, when you really took a look at what the company was doing and where it could be, these looked like, growth stocks in disguise, right? So, and who doesn't want to buy something that's worth a buck today, that you could get at 80 cents or 70 cents, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Everybody does, right? So, the value side worked for me. Growth is a wonderful thing to have, but I don't know, maybe it's my personality. I just drifted toward the value side. When you can work with someone who's got a lot of experience and has lived through as many cycles as Buzz has, it's an easy course to take. Mm-hmm. So I hope I answered that question.
Well, I want to follow up on it in the sense, like, was there like one experience where you're just like, okay, I get it now, or just like a funny experience where you like you took that and put it in your back pocket and pull it up anytime like something like that may happen again, anything like that happen?
I mean, there was a great time when I first joined Royce and started working with Buzz, and that it was June of 2002, and at that time there's a complete unraveling of technology, right? Mm-hmm. The quote-unquote tech bubble, right, was bursting. And you had scores of these companies that had come public. tremendous amounts of cash, because if you remember back then, you did your IPO, you filed your IPO at 10 to 12, they priced it at 20, the first trade was 34, and then a month later they were doing a secondary at 68, right? So these companies had extraordinarily high amounts of cash on their balance sheets, right? And many of them were not profitable. Many of them were quote-unquote pre-revenue, you know, whatever, you know, it's well documented. But when I and actually went out to San Francisco to help to the old Agent Q tech conference, which is now the J.P. Morgan tech conference in Boston, I think they do it now. And you, all of a sudden you were meeting with these companies that had all been, you know, newly minted companies in the last 2 years, IPOs, right? With some of them with a lot of new management. And you say, wow, you know, what an opportunity here. You know, these companies, there's no expectations for these things, right? Everybody has written them off as sort of flash in the pan, internet boom bust. You know, they don't make money. They don't even have really great revenue. But when you went and you talked to these managements, they were some of the happiest management teams I'd ever met in my life.
So,
I'm dying for another opportunity like this, because think about what they had. Here they are, you're the CEO, CFO of a company, right, that has no expectations, right? But they also have a boatload of cash. There's no venture money in there, you know, harping on them to do it this way, get it done this way. So they have the luxury of time, and they probably also have spent, you know, some incredible amount of money on R&D already. And, you know, yeah, so you have a product pipeline. And it was just a great moment in time. And I forget what our returns were in 2003. I think we were probably up, I don't know, somewhere between 60 and the high 70s%. Just because all these things in 2002 were just, you know, selling for less than the cash on the balance sheet. So it was just, you know, it's sort of the eye-opening experience that it could ever really happen, right? Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make sense. You know, why would you be able to buy something for, you know, less than the cash on the balance sheet?
Right.
You know, it doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it happened. That doesn't prevent it from happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, so I was fortunate in that I had made the change and went over there, and all of a sudden you had this, you know, great opportunity. But trust me, it didn't feel good every day, because, you know, I think if you look that second quarter of 2002, I think the Russell was probably down 20-odd%. So it's much easier for me to sit here right now and say, oh, wow, what a great year 2003 was. You know, it was not without, you didn't just go in and say, okay, look, this is easy. I'm just picking these things off. You know, there's a lot of work involved. You didn't know which ones were going to work. You know, and that's the other reason to be diversified, right? You just never know which ones are going to be the ones that the market falls in love with, and which ones are going to be, you know, sort of something that nobody ever cares about, right?
Mm-hmm. So then what is your advice for new microcap investors looking at, you know, this sector of the market?
You have to be very patient. It's a cliche, but you have to be a contrarian, mm-hmm. right? You just have to, right? Because, you know, the merchandise is really only available, you know, when nobody wants it.
Mm-hmm.
And usually when nobody wants it, there's a reason why nobody wants it, right? These things are not accidentally selling at these low multiples. They're selling at the low multiples because there's something wrong. So you've got to be patient. And I have colleagues who will disagree with me, but I think you have to be diversified because the liquidity stinks. And no matter how much work you do, there's just things that are beyond your control, right? You see in the newspaper every day, right? You pick up the paper, you see such and such was down 30 or 40% yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why was it down 30 or 40%? Well, no one expected whatever happened to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so you have to look out for that stuff. And the other thing I would say is, you know, learn from the bad markets. Yeah, because it's the bad markets where you really get to use your sort of contrarian instincts and you learn how much of a backbone you have too.
For sure.
But it's It's, you know, but it's a great, you know, it's a very, very satisfying thing to do. And it's a lot of fun. And if you're not having fun doing it, and if you don't love it, then I would suggest that you're not really going to be good at it. Because it is, you know, it's something that you have to, it's a lot of work. It's a very, very, very labor-intensive part of the market, because you have to do most of the work yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And even the names that we have where there is coverage, you know, to some extent, it's some analysts, you know, 11th and 12th name under coverage. And why are they covering it? Because the head of research said, you know what, you have to follow this many names. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. On the other hand, though, there's a tremendous amount of work out there, mostly done by boutiques, also done by people that used to be at big firms that sort of started their own thing, and they do tremendous work. And the reason they do tremendous work is because they love it. Mm-hmm. You know, they love the small companies. They love, you know, having access to the company, because the company doesn't have a lot of coverage, right? Mm-hmm. So my advice is that if you're passionate about stocks, you know, it's probably the best part of the market. You know, mm-hmm. There's lots of undiscovered things, and it's a part of the market where you find a $2 stock that goes to 12 or 13 mm-hmm. or 15. You know,
right.
And those opportunities are, I think, much more prevalent in the micro cap part of the market than the big cap. It's just, you know, the law of large numbers, right? It's very, very difficult for, you know, the bigger companies to grow. Even, you know, it's funny, even, I can remember we owned a little semiconductor device company, and the CEO said to me, he said, you know, well, you know, I'm expecting, you know, a lot of merger activity. And I said, why? He said, well, here, he says, think about a billion-dollar revenue company, you know, that loses, you know, 10% of its sales every year because they either lose a customer or because, you know, something end of cycle. And then all of a sudden you have to make up that $100 million in sales, and then you also have to get additional sales, right?
Right.
So unless it's a really good economy, you know, it's hard to sort of come up with that, you know, with that type of growth. Mm-hmm. So these are fun, fantastic companies. You meet a lot of great people, and it's not without risk, but you know, the rewards can be very, very good. It's much more volatile, which is something very, very different than risk. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to believe me. You could read Howard Marks' book, right? He'll tell you all about that
mm-hmm.
in a much better way than I could ever dream of. But it's true, you know, and if you take advantage of the volatility, you know, it's another way to really help your performance.
So, Bill, as we wrap up here, you know, where can my audience go and find more information about you and Royce Funds?
So you could go on the website, where we have lots of fun bios and charts and performance measures and there's probably lots of things. If you just type in Royce and Hench on the internet, you'll probably find some articles from the past too. And now they could go to this podcast.
Yes, they can. I'm so excited to put it out there. Bill, again, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you all for tuning into the Planet Microcap podcast. And thank you, Bill, again for coming onto the program. You can access the podcast by going on to stocknewsnow.com under podcast. Go to podbean.com and search Planet Microcap podcast, or on iTunes and search Planet Microcap podcast. Stay tuned for the next Planet Microcap podcast, where we'll have our next guest to discuss all things microcap. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, please send an email to info@stocknewsnow.com. I'd love to hear from all of you. This podcast has been brought to you by SNN Incorporated, publishers of stocknewsnow.com, the official microcap news source, and the Microcap Review magazine. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you again for joining me on the Planet Microcap podcast. Have a great week, everyone.